Thank you everybody for coming. It's I look forward to the experience of having the colloquium from this side. So
today I'm going to talk about quantum gravity. So I'll have to tell you a little bit about where this comes from. So the broader subject today is going to be emergent locality in quantum gravity, the possibility that geometry and locality does not exist at the fundamental level, but it's only something that happens at low energies. The context that I want to be studying this is really what can be thought of as background independent condensed matter physics for the purposes of quantum gravity, which is something that doesn't actually exist, so it's a somewhat unusual route, even though the question of emergent locality is something that is explored by other places as well. So since the whole point of condensed matter is that you get specific models and you study the interesting questions in specific models, I will be discussing a specific model today, which is quantum gravity. So I'll tell you what that model does. And it's going to be interesting because it will start off as a model for Planck scale physics, but we will be able to understand quite a few things about large scale physics from that. Or in any case, we'll make a connection between the Planck scale physics and, if you like, the largest scales in that model. While discussing the model, what I want to do is keep an eye on this condensed matter perspective in quantum gravity, which I believe brings in new questions or new insights and new ways to look at old questions. And that's going to be something that I'm quite interested in the whole talk. So what I'll talk about today is based on these four papers here. But more generally, this work is based on a whole bunch of things that I've done with several people here, who I thank greatly for their contributions. So here is the outlines of what I want to discuss today. So first of all, I'll give you some motivation. I'll say something brief about how I want to look at the problem of quantum gravity. And the particular physical question I will be asking today is, does geometry exist all the way to the Big Bang, just before you hit the singularity, like is usually thought of? Or is emergent geometry and locality something that applies only at very low energy? And more specifically, could it be that the microlocality, the locality at Planck scale, is different than the locality of our world? And if they're different, how could you see and what would happen? So I'll explain more carefully what I mean by these things. And I will advocate that emergent locality is an interesting thing to look at, and it's a place where one should be developing a quantum gravity phenomenology, because it's a place where we free ourselves from the Planck scale, possibly, and be able to get large-scale effects. So then I'll discuss this in this context of this particular model, which, as I said, is a condensed matter model of emergent locality, geometry, and matter, basic aspects of locality, geometry, and matter. And what we'll do is start with a model and end up finding that the model basically describes a variable speed of light cosmology. So what I'll do is discuss the states and the Hamiltonian of the model. I'll tell you how you get emergent matter in that model via string net condensation. Then we'll see how you get locality and geometry and which aspects of that emergent and how well you can do this part. And finally, we'll see that you get large-scale observational consequences in the sense that there is a varying speed of light in this system. And at the end, I'm going to discuss some of the questions that this type of approach raises and how they come about. And this in particular will be time, gravity, and quantum mechanics. So depending on how much time I have left down there. Okay. So quantum gravity. Why should you care about a quantum theory of gravity? Well, it's presumably not something I need to say here that we need a quantum theory of gravity. What I want to say is the following, that there is an old way and a new way to say why you need a quantum theory of gravity. So the old way, which is hopefully not that old, is basically definitely what happened when I was a graduate student, which hopefully is not a very long time ago. is that our understanding of the world at the most fundamental level boils down to two basic theories, quantum mechanics and general relativity. And quantum mechanics and general relativity are actually different enough that when you put them together, you have a problem. So we've tested them both very well. But for example, if you want to ask the question of what's inside a black hole or what was the Big Bang, then you get incoherent answers. And the common statement is you say that problems arise when gravity and quantum theory must coexist, so when the quantum effect of the gravitational field becomes significant. And that happens at the Planck scale. So you know for sure that you need new physics at Planck scale because your current theories break down there. However, the Planck scale is ridiculously small. So if that's the situation of you need physics at the Planck scale, then you probably will not expect to have lots of experimental guidance. So maybe you want to go, for example, with mathematical consistency of your theory or some fundamental principles and develop your quantum theory of gravity that way. However, a more modern way, I suppose, to think of why you need a quantum theory of gravity is that there is a lot out there that we do not know and that we do expect a quantum theory of gravity to have something to say about. So that happens at all levels. For a start, there has been in the last few years a lot of very interesting work on constraints on Lorentz invariant violation, which can pick up aspects of your theory at the Planck scale. So for example, if you have a theory that has a preferred frame of a certain kind at the Planck scale, you know that this is experimentally excluded. I mean, not a lot of people like this type of theories for other reasons, but you can actually already go from the Planck scale physics to basically observational fact. Plus, there is a lot that is out there that we do not know what it is, such as dark energy and dark matter. What is the inflaton? And a bunch of other questions, which in various forms, most of us expect a quantum theory of gravity to have something to say about. Whether you do, I don't know, string theory or loop quantum gravity, you actually are trying to test your theories against observations. So there has been now a shift from the Planck scale is very small to there is a lot of physics out there that we might very well need new physics for. So the way that I look at quantum, I want to look at quantum gravity these days, is basically not unlike other theories that we have. We know the macroscopic physics. We have GR, quantum field theory, and the physics that we know at low energy. And what we need is a microscopic theory. Now, there is many such cases in physics where we are in that situation. And a standard field of physics that we use to study situations where we know the macro physics and we need the microscopic physics is statistical physics or condensed matter. So for example, if you want to understand magnetism, you would use models of Eisenspins and see what it means to be magnetized. Now, this has not been something, condensed matter approaches have not really been looked at very much in quantum gravity so far, with very good reason. That if you think that you do not have experimental input, then there is very little value to this type of system, to this type of questions. So you would previously have said no experiments, no use for condensed matter approaches. However, this is not true anymore because there is all of these interesting observational questions out there that you may want to make a connection to from your theory. And in fact, this has been getting more and more attention these days. And in particular, in the context of what I'll be discussing here, several aspects of relativity can be reproduced in condensed matter physics. So analog models can reproduce a Lorentzian signature and Hawking radiation in what appears to be fluid in a Euclidean spacetime. When you're inside the fluid, it looks like you're actually in a Lorentzian world. Similarly, if the physics of the Fermi surface, the type of thing that Volovic does, also reproduces aspects of Lorentzian physics if you are inside the system. And string net condensation, we had a talk by Zhao Dan Gwen a couple of months ago, is another spin system that reproduces emergent matter. We're actually going to see this in this talk. And also spin two excitations, which are Graviton candidates. So this is a new thing that is being developed. And in fact, we had a meeting last year, which was a week-long meeting with several people bringing new things on the table in this direction of condensed matter approaches to quantum gravity. And what I'll talk about basically belongs to this world. So what I want to do is basically do an analog of, well, if I have a ferromagnet, the underlying system is the Ising model, to space-time. So my low energy physics is space-time. What model do I start from to get here? And what can I learn from that transition? So I will develop a system which goes in the direction of background independent condensed matter system. So it is to a substantial degree about background independent system. So it's not really very good if you want to understand space-time to have a helium fluid in your lab. That's very confusing. So it's kind of important to try to see how background independent you can make your physics. And the particular question that my model will be studying is the transition from micro-locality to macro-locality. And so quantum gravity, my model, is essentially going to be a spin system. So what do I want to study? So as usual, what you do with a condensed matter system is you want to study a phase transition from a micro to a macro. And in my case, the question would be the transition from an early high energy phase with no geometry to our world with geometry. So what I'm investigating here is the question of what if geometry and locality are not fundamental. First of all, how do you describe such a phase? What could this transition involve? And what signatures would it leave? And Friedman, Robertson, Walker, flat geometry. So roughly flat geometry. So that's our world. So standard cosmology usually basically has an FRW geometry all the way here. But I will investigate the situation where that description breaks down as you go back in the past. So why this? I'll take, yes, Steve?
Is it 3 geometry?
You mean as in, well, you have like a question about this?
Yeah.
This is a cartoon, so that's a very interesting point, of course. What does this mean? And I'll come back to that at the end. So why and where? So I'll give you a little bit, take maybe 4 minutes or something to give some background on what motivated this particular model I'll study here. So one question that is probably the main open question in background independent quantum theories of gravity is how do you get the low energy theory? So let's say that you have your favorite theory here that might be loop quantum gravity, spin foams, whatever it is that you like here, causal sets. How do you get from your high energy theory to the known theories so that you can A, test your theory, and B, test its predictions. So here is the type of things that might go on here. So for example, in loop quantum gravity, the basis states for quantum geometry are spin networks. You don't need to know anything about this. They're just graphs with some labels of SQ2 on them. What you need to know is that the result that makes people very excited about loop quantum gravity is the discreteness of spatial geometry at the quantum level. So the area operator in loop quantum gravity has areas that come in discrete quanta. So if you have a fundamental discreteness, you would expect that that might lead to Lorentz invariance violations at large scale, which is now an interesting question, because that might be something that you can test. So how do you go from the low energy theory to the Lorentz invariant violations possibly? If you can do that, then you would be making a connection to the whole field of discreteness phenomenology. Now,
This is an important question, and it is currently an open question because it involves a whole bunch of complications that are largely special to the background independent context and not having a well-defined notion of time. But for the purposes of what we have here, you can see something of what goes on. One very simple way to try to make a phenomenology from loop quantum gravity is to start with what's called weave states, which were proposed by these guys quite a while ago. These are special kinds of spin networks that are regular. They're regular graphs. And the areas and volumes on these graphs have properties so that this matches a semi-classical volume and area. So if you like, this is a discretization. Well, not really, but it's a discrete version of a spatial, classical spatial geometry. However, these states, when people study them, they assume them to be local. So in particular, you can see that I can make perturbations of that graph by adding an non-local edge. And there are n square ways to add non-local edges, while there are n ways to have n local edges, where n is the number of vertices on the graph. So these guys are actually unstable under non-local perturbations. So you might worry that just be interested that maybe the interesting phenomenology to look at here is not actually the discreteness one, but the locality. Why is locality stable, and if it's not stable, do you get something, some signature? Another way to see this is a different problem we studied at some point, is to ask the question of which do you have conserved quantities in the evolution of spin networks. This is actually easy to say what conserved quantities are. So I'll just reduce the problem to you have a network, and the network can evolve with certain very simple local rules. So this vertex on a network can change into that vertex, and so on. Right? These are local evolution moves that are the generators of evolution in spin networks. So the conserved sector will be the commutant of the evolution generated by these guys with the identity here. And you can find out what this is, and therefore what the conserved sector in the systems are. And that's what we did here. And we saw that these are basically braids and knots in the network. So the braiding content of a network cannot be changed by the evolution that is normally considered, and therefore it would be conserved. Now, the funny thing, of course, then you realize, is that the braids of, for example, this object here can be, you can twist the graph and the braid can go all over the place. So if this braid somehow represents a conserved quantity, that conserved quantity is not in any way localized on the underlying graph. So there is a bunch of hints from there that maybe when you start, when you work with a quantum geometry and you want to understand how classical, semi-classical geometry comes out, one of the things that seem to be very non-trivial but has not been looked at very much is how locality comes out. Yes?
Just in a quest to understand better what you mean by non-local conserved quantities here, it seems that, for instance, the baryon number is something where it is conserved. You can create a particle and an antiparticle.
Yep.
The creation and annihilation events happen locally, but the baryon number as a whole seems to be a non-local property, right? Because the particle and the antiparticle go far apart.
Right.
So,
and that's indeed the type of thing that you can say is conserved here. But you would like more than that, right? You would hope that the conserved quantities somehow correspond to, I don't know, a proton or something like that. That should be an actual local object. If you have a global quantity like that that is conserved, that's no problem. So that may be the answer, but that doesn't seem to be the only thing.
Okay.
Yes?
Another question. Thinking of those spin networks, should I be sort of trying to visualize something that's sort of three-dimensional or undefined?
Yes, it's three-dimensional. Yeah. Or undefined dimension. So you might say, well, I don't actually care about this whole thing here because I don't do background independent quantum theory, so I actually don't think that the quantum theory graph is a quantization of GR. So in particular, you might say, well, gravity is only emergent, like you would presumably do if you do string theory, if you like ABS CFT, if you have considered black hole thermodynamics and so on. And I actually like that perspective. I think that that's probably correct. But if gravity is only emergent, then you have to worry about these questions even more. Because gravity is equivalent to geometry, and geometry defines locality. So if gravity is emergent, then the locality and the geometry should also be emergent. Otherwise, you're doing something quite strange. So let's think about it in fairly simple terms. So there is a whole bunch of reasons why people think that gravity is emergent, but we don't have to go into those. We can just think by analogy to the physics that we know. So the quantum theory of gravity is supposed to live at Planck scale, and we're looking for physics at best, the best of physics that we know is high energy physics. So the discrepancy between what we're looking for and what we know is 20 orders of magnitude. So in any other physical system, when I go up by much less than 20 orders of magnitude, I undergo a phase transition. And it would make sense to expect this here. So an analogy that you could use is fluid dynamics and the underlying theory, quantum molecular dynamics. So the degrees of freedom are different. So here you have your molecules with an intermolecular potential in the Schrödinger equation, and here you have waves satisfying continuity in Euler equations and so on. So the important thing is that you use different degrees of freedom to describe the two phases. In particular, there are waves in the low energy physics, and there are no waves to be found in the high energy physics. So if you make the analogy that your gravitational, or GR, or geometry is what exists here, then you should not actually expect to have geometric degrees of freedom at high energy,
quantum geometric or geometric or anything like that. So I'm going to put it in a rather provocative way, because you've just eaten, so maybe that wakes people up. I would take the viewpoint here that the fundamental theory cannot have geometric degrees of freedom, that there must have been a transition from a previous high-energy phase that had no geometry to our world that has geometry. And that's what I'm going to study today. And before I get to study that, you'll have to maybe worry, well, if I want to model something that has no geometry, how do I do it? Because everything that we normally do is in a geometry. So you take a spin system, and the lattice is in some spacetime. That's not really going to be too much of a problem. The perspective I'll take here is that you could use quantum information before you have geometry. And that's based on a bunch of things that we've done before, where, in fact, it's not very difficult to map a whole large class of quantum gravity systems, in particular evolving spin networks, as quantum information processing systems. And then it makes it easier to drop many aspects of geometry when you're there. OK, so let's get now to the actual model. So first of all, I want to clarify one thing, because that's sometimes a point of confusion. I'm not looking for non-locality in the sense that I'll have a Lagrangian in some quantum field theory, and I'll have non-local terms on that. What I'm looking for is a situation where I have fundamental theory that is local and an effective theory that is also local, but the two localities are not the same. So that's what I want to study. And so then I want to go, as I said, from the non-geometric to the geometric phase. I use the fancy Greek word here to describe the transition. So geometrogenesis means that you get geometry out. Greek words are easier if you're Greek somehow. It doesn't really go. It's, at least for me, it's simpler than say that now geometry emerges. What features do I want from the non-geometric and from the geometric phase? So I'll think of a system as being geometric when it has a good notion of locality. It has symmetries that I identify as geometric symmetries, such as translations and so on, and a good dimensionality, like 3+1 is a good one. And the non-geometric phase is when I don't have these things. So what is a good model for that? Yes.
Slide, you suggested quantum information processing as a way of thinking about non-geometric models. And what's bothering me is that most of the quantum information that I know, particularly the processing bit, is strongly influenced by locality. That we consider what you can do where you have interactions between subsystems that only involve a small number of subsystems at once, like two.
Sure.
Without that, it seems that quantum information processing
No, but that's perfectly fine. That's exactly what I'm using. But that would be my micro-locality.
So there is a locality.
There is
a
locality.
It's just not ours.
Yes, it's just not ours.
Okay.
So that's the whole thing that I'm actually studying, is what if that locality is not ours?
Is there also potentially a micro-geometry?
Well, if you see my system, it would not make sense to call that a geometry. Okay, so here is my model, the preview. So that's going to be my world at high energy where there is no geometry. And that will be the world at low energy where there is a geometry, and there will also be matter. So the world at high energy will have no locality. The way I will model it is with a graph where everybody's connected to everybody else. It has no locality in the sense that there is no useful subsystems here. So let's say that you pick this vertex, and you ask, what is the neighborhood of that vertex? It's everybody. So you cannot split this guy into neighborhoods. And since you can't do that, I will say that this has no subsystems, therefore it has no locality. This will have microscopic degrees of freedom on this, spins, I'll show you in a slide. And I will call those micromatter, just my microscopic degrees of freedom. And then at low energy, I will have a dynamics that transitions from this to a graph that has many fewer edges, and which can be identified as a discretization, say, of a flat space time. That would be very nice. Plus, so this is, of course, local, because now you don't have meaningful. I mean, that's just a discretization of an FRW, so I'm not really doing anything fancy here. This is clearly local. And this will also have effective matter degrees of freedom. And I'll show you how. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Sure. As a quantum computing person, should I think of the vertices of the graph on the left as quantum registers, like qubits? So if they're n qubits, there are n vertices, or should I think of them as the points in the sort of the dimension of the Hilbert space?
I'll show you in the next slide. The qubits are the edges, not the vertices.
Oh.
So now I should say that there is a subtle point here, but for the purpose of this talk, the geometry would be the geometry defined by the graph. So a path, a geodesic in the graph will be a geodesic in my geometry. So that makes things simpler. Okay, so now let me tell you.
Dean,
yes.
Go ahead. Can we go back? So I understand non-local, local in the pictures here, but on the previous transparency, you were saying there was a locality on both sides.
Yeah.
So can you tell me what's where
yes.
It says non-local?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I just show you
okay,
the next slide? And I'll tell you why. So first let me define a couple of things. So if I have n vertices, kn is a complete graph on those n vertices, which will have n and minus 1 over 2 edges. So my qubits, or micromatter, or fundamental degrees of freedom, are spins on the edge. So each edge gets two quantum numbers, j and m. And the j can take two values, 1 and 0. So 1 means that the edge is on, that is, A and B are connected, and 0 is the edge is off, A and B are not connected. In order to get the emergent matter out, I will need to have a little bit more information. So I will need to have different ways to be connected, and this is the M values. So in fact, when you're connected, you could be connected as plus 1, minus 1, and 0. So this is a way to interpret the usual J and M values in
basically four dimensions associated.
Yeah. And now here is why we are local. So the total Hilbert space is simply the direct product of all the edge spaces, and the Hamiltonian is going to be acting on them pairwise. Okay, maybe we should be discussing of what you mean by local, but anyway, that's what my system does. Okay. So the total Hilbert space is the tensor product of all the edge Hilbert spaces. Now, a particular stage in my state space will be a sum, therefore, of subgraphs of Kn. So a particular assignment of zeros and ones here, a particular state, is actually a subgraph on n. So for example, this graph here has 10 vertices, so does this one. So if I put the right zeros and ones on this, then I get that. So the generic state is going to be a superposition of such dots with colors. And I will now cook up a Hamiltonian that assigns a certain energy to each graph, so that when I minimize the energy, I get what I want. So that's the game. And okay, so that I probably won't be going into such detail, but JNMs are standard JNMs, and you can use the standard JNMs operator or something. Right. So now my goal is to use a Hamiltonian such that the following can happen. So my high energy phase with no locality, the Kn, becomes what I will read off as a low energy phase with locality. That would be a low degree connected graph. The second is that that should be something that is tractable enough that I can get to possible observable effects of the transition from the local to the, well, the non-local to the local. Maybe you should find better names for that, but I hope that given that I give you a specific model, you can follow what I'm doing. And not worry about what exactly non-locality means. It's a loaded word, non-locality, and people might mean a lot of things. But I've defined it here, so you know what I mean. So the other things that I want the low-energy phase to contain emergent matter via the string network condensation of Levin and Wen. Then I want to have aspects of gravity. So my matter, the effective matter, should affect the effective geometry and vice versa. And I would also be very happy if my low-energy phase here did not just have locality, but was also regular, say a discretization for an FRW. That's not essential for what I'm going to try to do. It's bonus points, but we're going to try to get there too. So for what I do today, these three you can do fairly straightforwardly. This is a nice, interesting direction that we'll discuss a little bit. And this one can maybe get there or not, but I'll tell you how. Yes? Was there a question? Okay. Okay, so since the Hamiltonian just acts on graphs, and graphs are simple things, so are just made of vertices and edges, the Hamiltonian will have one part that acts on vertices and one part that acts on edges. And the edges can be in different configurations. You can either have open strings of edges, or closed strings of edges, or loops. So these are the only three types of terms that you can have acting on a graph. And we'll take them one by one. So the first one.
That's not a self loop.
Yes. No, I mean a sequence of edges that does not close. You will see some strings coming out. So the vertex term is a very easy term. What it does is that it simply kills a lot of edges. So it lowers the degree of the vertex, and therefore you automatically expand the graph. So
it has this form. So this term here basically is the degree of the vertex. So this is the degree of vertex B. So this tells you that unless the degree of every vertex is V0, where V0 is a parameter in the system, you pay a penalty. No rocket science here. So by basically choosing this parameter, you make your system have minimum energy graphs of a certain degree. So if I choose V0 being 3, then all of these guys minimize this term. Now, so for the purposes of locality here, which means do I have meaningful subsystems that is long distances from one vertex to another, this already gives me locality. You might think, however, that locality without a nice notion of geometry is not good enough, and I'll sympathize with you and we'll get there. But so if I minimize this, I get a variety of possibilities for the ground energy. And some of them I will probably like better than others as geometry candidates. So for example, this seems to be a nicer candidate for a discretization of a flat spacetime than this one. And the way that these are different, all of these are different, is in the distribution of loops in the graph. And the rest of the terms we're gonna control the distribution of loops. Don't have much time, so.
Cartoon of some three-dimensional structure. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I know there's no real dimension here, but that's.
Okay. Here I wanted to tell you that there is a really cute way to count paths in a graph that non-retracing paths. So for example, people often count paths in a graph using the adjacency matrix. So I'll just say this for whoever happens to know that and not spend any much time. But the adjacency matrix can retrace, go back and forward. So if you use instead of the adjacency matrix, this version, if you like, of the adjacency matrix, whose entries are sequences of creation and annihilation operators acting on the edge, that also gives you 0 and 1. And then you normal order that object, then you have this operator here whose powers return the number of non-tracing paths between A and B of length L. So I want to discuss other things more. So if you want to know how to count non-retracing paths in a graph, I can tell you afterwards. So, but the point is that my operator goes in here in the next term that controls the loops. And so this guy here counts loops of length L. So this operator has this form. And there's an exponential here, and L is the size of the length of the loops. So this basically has this type of form. So it prefers loops distributed around a certain value, L star, which depends on R. So for example, these are graphs that all have 6 loops. Now the question is, which one does this term prefer? It would be nice if you preferred those over those. Is that true? Is there a set of parameters for which this discretization of effort doubling in 2 dimensions is the ground state? And, well, you can find some answers to this problem. It's a difficult problem. And the answer is that for colorless graphs, when I don't care about the m values, I only have j, 0, and 1, the answer is yes, but with an additional assumption, which I'll tell you in a second. Otherwise, this is still a minimum, and it's a stable local minimum. For colored graphs, that gets more interesting, because then I also get matter, and the answer is not clear. So I'll tell you what the results are. So colorless graphs is when I only have J labels on my spins. So then I can now look at the Hamilton that I had before, the vertex term and the loops term I just gave you, and see, for example, what the energy of this graph and that graph and that graph are. But I'm only going to compare graphs that are homogeneous. That is, the neighborhood of a vertex is the same wherever you are in the graph. And then what you can see is that, in fact, if you are just sitting on this vertex here or there, these guys have more loops around a given vertex on average than this one. So if you only look at your neighborhood, it looks like this has lower energy, because the more loops you have, the more you lower the energy. But the term that we have actually looks at not just at what happens when you sit on the vertex, but what happens also when you go a little bit outside. And when you get a bit outside, then the fact that this is, in essence, a two-dimensional space means that eventually the energy of this graph, so this is in the plot, that's the hex, the red one, if you study the neighborhoods going out far enough, eventually the hexagon is indeed the lowest energy state.
Can you remind me where does the energy go? In the matter. So when you lower the
You wait. But good question. Right now it doesn't go anywhere. You put it in a fridge, and I don't know who the fridge is. But we'll get back to that. So, with homogeneity of the vertices, there are sets of parameters, for example, these particular ones here, that give you a nice flat space as a ground state.
What happens when you drop homogeneity?
Yes, so I'll tell you. So with no homogeneity of the vertices, this is still a local minimum, and it's stable, so if you perturb the thing, if you have for example, this, and you perturb it this way, it continues to be a minimum. So you are in a local minimum. But it is not the ground state. So with no homogeneity of the vertices, it also becomes a much harder problem to study. So the best that we have done, so we don't actually have the final answer on what is the ground state. So the best that has been done is what Tomáš did, who did a Monte Carlo simulation, which, however, was limited from the resource he had. So in fact,
this is the ground state, not quite for the parameters that we actually wanted, but for the parameters that his computer could deal with. But you could argue that you basically get bubbles of connected guys, but in fact a big string of bubbles. So that would not be a nice geometry. Now, however, before you, so initially we thought, well, we should be able to get what we want by just reducing the system to the zero and one situation, which is of course simpler. But in fact, that seems to miss a lot of the physics. So in particular, which geometry you get actually depends on the matter. So it depends on the M values. So I'll tell you what the M values have to do with matter. So now we have graphs with color. So the graphs now have J's and M's. And now we go back to the term we had before, but we revise it. And we revise it so that it now looks, well, in fact it is, the Hamiltonian of string and when. So in fact, our whole system is, if you like, the when string net condensation adapted to dynamical graphs. So you now have colors. So your links do not have to be all black. They can also be red and blue and black. You get two terms. And I'll just tell you what they do. So this term basically tells you that you would prefer all edges to be black, all values to be zero. However, you have this very interesting term here, which is similar to what we had before. But it tells you that even if you had gotten to the ground state we just had, you could actually lower the energy even further. There is a minus sign here. By creating M loops. These are closed loops of alternating colors, like this one here. So that now means that you have two phases in your system. So this term has an opposite sign to that. So you could be in a situation where this term wins or this term wins, depending, let me just finish now, depending on what the couplings are. And the interesting situation is when this term wins, and then your minimum energy state is when you have all possible loops, M loops, in the system. And that is what is called a string net condenser. And the interesting thing with that is that's the work of Wen and company, which he gave a great talk in November. And I will not try to do any justice to it. I'll just say what I need for what I'm doing here. That in fact, you can map this Hamiltonian at low energy to the Kogut-Suskind Hamiltonian for lattice QED. So in effect, you can reduce this to a U1 theory. So the string net condensation means that you have emergent photons and fermions, where if you want to have some intuitive sense of where these guys are, roughly speaking, the photons have something to do with fluxes through those M loops. And the fermions are related to the edges, to the free edges of the open strings. So since our system now has this Hamiltonian here, at low energy, we also get this emergent photons and fermions. Yes?
The vertex Hamiltonians, you sort of motivated. You said, well, we put this in because we want this, we put that in. Are these, do you invent these for some particular reason, or are they derived from something, or where did these Hamiltonians come from?
Well, so this depends what you mean. So for us, these Hamiltonians came from there, from when and collaborators work, modified so that this term also affects the graph, like I was describing before. We can discuss where he got it from and why he designed it that way, but we can do that afterwards. Okay, so now you can see that the situation is intricate. So now my Hamiltonian seems to determine both the geometry and the matter. And in fact, you could write the partition function for the system in the following way, where this is the usual weight by energy of a graph, but there is a factor in front, which depends, if you like, on the matter content, on the colors. So in the case where I have no colors is when this factor is 1, and that's what I could analyze before. But with colors,
this is a different factor, and therefore my ground state changes. So adding color changes the ground state of the graph, or another way to say that is that you cannot actually split the geometry from the matter. Now that has good aspects and bad aspects. The good is that the geometry is not independent from the matter, which is something that we actually wanted because it does remind you a bit of GR. One made the model kind of on purpose to have that feature. The bad, unfortunately, is that it's complicated. The whole point with condensed matter models is that they should stay tractable. So complicated now, of course, you can deal with it in a number of ways. You can reduce the problem to more specific questions. So Tomasz has been studying the situation of can the matter play the role of the homogenizing condition. He finds that kind of yes, that needs more work, so I can't really say whether the answer is yes or not, but it seems possible. And we have been working on basically a new version of the system, which is actually simpler, that studies this particular problem. Yeah, when we designed quantum graphics, the first time we thought it's really simple because I came from working on much more complicated systems, and that seemed really naive. But in fact, for the purposes of studying a condensed matter system, it's almost too complicated. So in the new model, Federico, that new model also has a nice feature where when you erase graph edge, you transfer the energy to the matter, which this model does not have. Okay, so this is the summary of my model. Then I'll take a few minutes to say why I like it, actually. As I said before, the idea is that you start from the completely connected graph and you go to something which has very low connectivity and aspects of space plus matter. I forgot the matter there. And roughly speaking, these are the features. So on this phase of high temperature, you have permutation symmetry, while here you have translations and rotations and so on, discrete symmetries. There is no locality here, while there's locality there. Both sides are relational in the sense that it's just a graph system. The average distance between two vertices here is 1, while on this side it can be something large, which means that you could think of this side as nearly infinite dimensional. This is a low dimensional system. This has no subsystems, and this does. And there's something that I did not discuss, which is that this has only external time, where here, in principle, you could define both external and internal time. I'll say something about that near the end, depending on how much time I have. And this is microscopic degrees of freedom, my J's and M's, while this one, the degrees of freedom, is the matter, plus a geometry which is dynamical in the sense that it responds to the matter. And in order to do this transition, I needed 4 couplings and a bunch of parameters. Now, okay, what do I want to do with this? Let's try to use it somewhere. So I'm going to now change a little bit gears and ask the question, if such a transition did happen, would you see it? And how would you see it? Now, an obvious place to look for, of course, if you think that there was a different local structure in the early universe, is in the horizon problem. So I don't probably have to say, well, the horizon problem here is in this audience, but just very quickly, it is that you see, if you look out in the sky, you see almost parts of the sky being at the same temperature. And if you extrapolate our past life on, you find that there didn't seem to be enough time between the Big Bang and how far you can see for those opposite parts of the sky to come into causal contact, so that there is a reason why they're at the same temperature. So the way that we solve that problem is, of course, inflation, where you say, well, the time from the Big Bang to that picture involved a period of exponential expansion, so there is actually a way for these opposite points to come into thermal contact. But from this perspective, you see that the horizon problem as something that actually needs, at step one, to say, I'm assuming that our causal structure extrapolates all the way to the Big Bang. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the problem to start with. And in this case, that is not true. And in fact, you could follow it in explicit steps. So if I can make here a 1+1 discrete cartoon version of the horizon problem. So we are here, and this is our past life cone, and we see that this guy and that guy are at the same temperature. And this is the Big Bang, and that's the forward life cone of the Big Bang.
And therefore, there doesn't seem to be a way for these two to have common causal contact. In our world, however, the early universe had more connections. So the correct light cone should be this. Well, so this is a hand-waving argument, but you can actually make that precise and get interesting answers. So what you will find, and I'll show you in the next slide how to do that, is that in quantum gravity, the speed of light, if you like, which means the speed that information propagates, changes in time due to a bunch of things. That there are more links at earlier times, like this intuitive picture said, but also the higher connectivity in itself increases the speed of information propagation. And there is also the possibility of superluminal excitations at higher energy. So the way that you can study this is just go back to the original Levin and Wendt system and look at what is the speed of light in string net condensation. So what you do there is that you start from the Hamiltonian that I was showing you earlier, and you find that in the low energy limit, it maps to the Maxwell Lagrangian. When you do the mapping, you have some leftovers. So J and G are the couplings in the original Hamiltonian, that appear in the original Hamiltonian. So in order then for this to be standard electrodynamics, you make the identification of the speed of light is root 2 GJ. But you can ask the question of how come this is the speed of light? Can you just see that starting from the microscopic interactions at that level? And the way that we did that is we started with an interesting tool, the Lieb-Robinson bound for the speed of information propagation in a local system. So if you have a local Hamiltonian, the intuition here is pretty simple. If you have a local Hamiltonian where neighbors talk to each other, it would take a while for a signal to go from here to a long way because they have to talk and then the other guys have to talk and so on, right? So that basically captures that concept. It tells you that if you have a local Hamiltonian, which is a sum of a bunch of terms, and you look at, say, operators at P and operators at Q, then it will take some time for information to propagate between the two. And you can quantify this by looking at the norm of the commutators, of operators at P at time T with operators at Q at time zero. And the norm is bounded by an object here, which you don't have to look at very carefully. But what goes in here is the couplings in the Hamiltonian, the maximum couplings in the Hamiltonian, as well as the number of paths that you have to go from P to Q. And you can rewrite this bound in a way that defines a speed. So this is the same bound described, rewritten in this form, where now V is the speed that information propagates from P to Q, or the Lieb-Robinson speed. Now, this bound, as it came in this work, is kind of loose for a number of reasons. So it doesn't look at the details of the Hamiltonian. You also only pick at the maximum couplings and so on. So we had to do some work to tighten it up. But you can do that. And you can find two interesting things. The one is that you can confirm the speed of Levin and Wendt. So indeed, at U goes to infinity, which means at low energy, the speed of information propagation in the system, the Lieb-Robinson speed, is the root 2 GJ. But then you find another interesting thing for us. So we have a situation where in time, in our cosmology, if you like, you go from the completely connected graph to a very low connectivity graph. So you can approximate this process by a sequence of hypercubic lattices whose dimension varies in time, right? So initially you start with a nearly infinite dimensional system or n squared dimensional system, and then you end up with a three-dimensional system. So if you approximate the evolution of the quantum gravity system with a hypercube whose dimension varies in time, then you find that the speed of light in this system goes with the dimension. So it actually drops with the dimension of the system. So you have a picture that is a bit like this. You start very connected and with very high speed, and then you drop to something that has low connectivity and also low speed. And you can more or less follow a bunch of these details in this system. So this is interesting, first of all, because you have a precise way to say in what sense correlations at early times do not violate causality. And also, it seems to show that the early expansion is similar to inflation. But what is also very interesting about it is that it seems that we have now mapped our condensed matter system to the whole field of variable speed of light cosmologies. So variable speed of light cosmologies are basically cosmologies in which the speed of light changes in time. And there is a whole bunch of different versions of that. So John Moffat is our guy that does that. But yes, just one second. Yes, sorry.
And then you compute and show that C of T scales in the same way. So you choose that the dimension changes with time in that way, and then you compute that the speed of light changes.
Well, you say, what you do is if you say, the dimension is D, what is C? And then you find what it is. And then you make a separate discussion of how does D fall in time, which is not as precise, but you can sort of argue that it falls like that, in which case the C should fall like that too.
That's using which dynamics? The dynamics of your model before? Sorry.
You don't actually need to discuss this. You don't need to talk about the dynamics very much. I can tell you what it is that you need, but you can ask me maybe if I finish this, or what it is that how I get that out. So what is interesting about this is that the variable speed of light cosmologies have been studied quite a bit, and in fact you can address a whole bunch of questions in cosmology that way. But you would, first of all, you have to understand what type of speed of light cosmology you have, which is something that we are doing now with Francesco, who is hopefully very busy. And of course, the obvious thing is, could you go far enough to get the spectrum fluctuations out? So that is, I don't know, I do find it quite exciting that you can go that far with fairly concrete steps. Because after all, I did start with a model at Planck scale, and I'm telling you something about large scale physics. So that's basically what I find interesting, that I've started studying this discrepancy between the two locales and get large scale physics. Okay.
As a question or something, that it seems to me that in your case, in the case of medieval Lucas variable speed of light, they assume that the dimension is still 4.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas in this case,
so it is not quite right. So that's, tell Francesco that we should work harder. I think that that's the interesting thing too, though, because there's not very many ways to get a variable speed of light cosmology from something. You usually just do this very artificial thing of you take C and make C of T, and rewrite all the equations you know that way. But you can see what goes on here. Anyway, all right. So at this point, what I want to do is take three slides or so to raise three questions that you should be raising at this point. So one is this question of the temperature or the bath. So that's something that I've been asked many times when I was showing this to people. So I go from high temperature to low temperature. So I actually go, what I'm looking for is a minimized energy state. So where does the energy go? Where does the temperature go? Do you require an external bath? Now, there's a whole bunch of different ways to try to answer that question. But for here, the answer is no. You can actually make energy conserving versions of this, which is the quantum gravity 2.0 thing that is coming here. And there, basically, what happens is when you erase an edge, you create matter. So, second, time. So the background independent people should be very itchy in their seats and say, well, but you have a Hamiltonian and a Hamiltonian has a time, so are you background independent? If I have time, then a lot of things should be solved, and et cetera. So I have a Hamiltonian. Indeed, the Hamiltonian in many ways implies a time, whichever way you cut it. So what about that? What's the issue?
So I think this is very interesting, and very much the reason that I'm studying these type of models is to actually understand that question. And so what I'm going to do for today is break down this question, what are the implications of time in the Hamiltonian, to more specific questions. So first of all, the time in which geometry, you have two geometries that are relevant here. One is the external, the way the graph looks like if you're God. This is the graph distances, which is all that we've been discussing today. But you also have an internal one, which is if you're an excitation in the system, what geometry do you see? And it's known that these two can be different. For example, in analog models, you have a fluid, and the external geometry is clearly Euclidean space. But if you're inside the system, you see a Lorentzian geometry. So the time that is relevant here would really be the G naught naught of the internal geometry that the observer should see. This is not something that we have actually done at this point explicitly. What is the internal geometry in the system? But so I'm here raising the flag that it's not actually obvious which time and which geometry you should be looking at, and which one should come into, if you want, your experimental constraints, the preferred frame. A second point is this question about time in the context of emerging geometry can be translated as the question of, is diffeomorphism invariance fundamental, or is it an effective symmetry? So if you do quantization of GR, you normally think that diffeomorphism invariance is fundamental and you want to impose it in the context of theory of gravity, but possibly it is effective. This is something that people have started studying recently, and this is an interesting paper by Jorge Pullin on emergent diffeomorphism invariance in a single discrete model. So this is something that one could should understand better. And another point is, well, maybe you do need time after all, but how much time do you need? That is, do you really need an actual proper foliation, or can you have a little bit? So this is better said in the context of a specific model. For example, in CDT, causal dynamical triangulations, for those who have seen it before, you actually do have a time, which is the suppressing causality splits, right? So you cannot have Fortin space times in CDT. So not having Fortin space time in CDT implies that you have a time, but apparently you can loosen it up. You can allow a whole bunch of Fortin to go on without changing the universality class you're in. So it's not completely obvious how strongly you need the time. And that is a question that has not even been formulated properly, but I do want to flag it, that the world might not be either you have a preferred frame and Newtonian world, or you're fully diffeomorphism invariant. There might be something between the two. And that's an interesting way to understand it.
Some of the questions that you mentioned here, you don't address one thing, and the fact that since you have a Hamiltonian, there's over and above all this an external time. Right?
Yeah,
this external time has nothing to do with the internal time that could have emerging, or the diff invariance that could have emerged, et cetera.
Yeah, but you might not be able to see.
Yeah, but it's part of the system, right?
Yeah. But if it's such that I can still look like I'm in a world with diffeomorphism invariance, then why do I care if there is such a thing? Okay, so then there was gravity, so I'm not completely sure how much more you want me to talk. For gravity, I just want to say, I'll say this thing maybe and stop. You can study gravity explicitly in the model, but I won't tell you how to do that. I'll tell you what the bigger picture is. Which is that basically you have a system where you start with some microscopic degrees of freedom from which you get both geometry and matter. And what we've been trying to do here is basically realize the following conjecture, that you start with a quantum system with no geometry, and from that you extract effective excitations. And you use this to describe both the geometry and the matter, like we do in this system. Then the R mu nu and the T mu nu will not be independent because they came from the same underlying degrees of freedom, the J's and the N's. And the relation is going to be the Einstein equation to lowest order. So our plan is to try to see if that indeed realizes this, that these two guys cannot be independent when they came from the same underlying degrees of freedom and the same Hamiltonian.
Just to clarify here, by lowest order, I guess you mean in the plant length, so at least in the classical limit?
No, I'm just saying that you might get Arminian squares or stuff like that, right?
Because you would also expect the relation to sort of break down to the quantum fluctuation.
Yeah, that will happen too, yeah.
Lowest order also.
Yeah, of course. Okay, quantum mechanics I won't tell you about, and I'll just stop here and just say, well, what we've studied is a model of geometrogenesis. Basically, we studied the possibility that our locality is non-fundamental, and that there is a discrepancy between the high-energy locality and our locality. I do think that it's interesting to study quantum gravity as a problem in condensed matter, which is what we did in this model. And what we got in this particular one is a flat geometry with a stable minimum, a geometry in a matter that are not independent, and a variable speed of light. And most interesting, we got the possibility of large-scale observational consequences, which might, of course, mean that your theory is wrong, but if you do quantum gravity, that's a good thing. And so I would really like to understand this more. Thanks.
Few questions. Can you get back to the time slide? Thank you. This business of like distinguishing the internal and internal time. Now, you say that there can be different concepts inside with the internal observer and the external observer, but and they might mainly have nothing to do with each other. But as far as I know, in condensed state matter systems, that's never the case. It's always the case that there is a big connection between the internal and external time, and the Lorentzian symmetry always breaks down in some frame which is very much connected to the external time. Right, so what's your view on kind of what causes that problem, how universal it is? You know, if you've got any special ideas to kind of get around that and generalize it?
Yeah, so I think that's partly what I wanted to study with this type of system. So I think that you do need some version of a condensed matter system that is, if you like, more backgrounding of that. So this particular one's are these network-based systems. So it's important to be inside the system, but, what I'm saying is that these type of systems that you're describing have more input than just the time in the Hamiltonian. They also have the space of the lab that the system lives in. And this is relational in some ways, much more than those original ones. So I don't actually know how it works on these ones.
On the same slide, does Lucien's work on dealing with indeterminate causal structures, is that useful for this program, or do you get a free pass out of that because you have an external time notion? Do you need that sort of theory?
Interesting question. I haven't thought about it. I probably should think before answering.
How do you pronounce mu a t t?
Micromatter?
Okay.
Is that Greek?
Hardly.
Thanks for seeing me again.